1 Samuel chapter 26. And the Ziphites came unto Saul to Gibeah, saying, Doth not David hide himself in the hill of Hakkelah, which is before Jeshimon? And Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. Now, the Ziphites, you might remember, they've done this before. They seem to be loyal to the king. From our perspective, they're pathetic scoundrels, you know, to give David and an innocent guy like David's location away on several occasions. You know, no doubt they were looking for benefits from the king. They're looking for perks in life. Those type of people that would sell out their neighbor for, you know, governmental goodies, I suppose, is certainly the truth of the Ziphites. So we don't like these people. I'm sure I'm in good company. But what's interesting about this guy, Saul, since the cave incident, he hasn't shown any hostility towards David. He seems to be kind of minding his own business, and some time has gone by. Is this a temptation for Saul that caused a relapse, if you understand where I'm going with that? He gets some information, he sees the opportunity, and he just can't help himself, and he goes after David again. You know, sin, let's just deal with a very simple biblical word, sin. It's actually an English word. It's an archer's term. And sin just means to miss the bullseye. That's really what it means, to miss the mark, okay? And I want to really quickly, for the sake of maybe new people in here, new to the faith, new to the scriptures, I want to describe to you the difference between the sin of a believer and the sin of a non-believer. Because guess what, brothers and sisters in Christ? We're still at it, aren't we? We still have sin that we need to ask for forgiveness and overcome and praise God for his mercy. And we're growing, but we still got these things that we deal with. So here's the deal, guys. The sin of the believer looks like this. And I would start with the life of the believer. The life of the believer is to aim our life towards the bullseye, which is Christ, right? You all know that's not the pastor. It's not a human. That's not who your eyes are on, right? The perfect, holy standard is Christ himself. That is our aim, okay? But because we are less than perfect, how many fall short of the glory of God? All, right? There's none righteous, no, not. That's right. So as we aim for the bullseye, as we aim for Christ, we're firing our arrows, but we're less than perfect. We miss, don't we? We miss the standard. And that is the sin of the believer. Our will, our intention is to follow Christ, but we are less than perfect. There is no question about that. But do you remember being a non-believer? Remember being behind the bow and arrow in those days? Weren't very concerned about the bullseye at all, were you? Weren't concerned about a standard at all. You literally fired arrows in every direction, behind the back, between the legs. You didn't care where the arrows flew. Do you understand the difference, the hope and the desire to be like Christ? A truly converted person does have that concern to please God. I think that's one of the evidences of salvation, in fact. A love for Christ and a desire to be clean. And that's important. So, sin. It's out there. And there's two components that make sin, sin. Are you ready? And you've heard this, many of you. It's desire and opportunity. There you have it. And what's the goal to overcome sin? The goal, practically speaking, is to keep desire and opportunity far apart, right? You have desires, you have sinful desires. It's intimidating at times, isn't it? How thoughts fleet across our mind. You're like, man, where did that come from? I know better than that, but that's that sin that dwells in us that the scriptures talk so much about. Get a grip, church folk in the room. We compete with these things. We have these things in our heart that we have to suppress and deny and say no to every single day. And I have some brothers in the Lord that are older men. They're on their last lap. I've checked. It's still there. It's still there. They still compete with those things. So it's important that we understand that there are desires that we have that, guess what? They're not okay. They're actually indications that we're messed up and estranged from God and wicked at our root, okay? But the key is knowing those desires in our heart We keep ourselves from the opportunity to give in to those desires. That's what the scriptures talk about when it says, don't make provision for the flesh. Don't pack a lunch. Don't put money in your pocket knowing you're going to be there that day or there tomorrow. Don't make provision so that you can give in to that desire. Man, could it be that simple, right? Could it be that simple? I smoked cigarettes for years. I smoked as many as 3 packs a day at one point. And there was a time in my life I couldn't take any money to lunch because I wanted to overcome. I wanted to be a healthy dad. I didn't want to spend money on that personally anymore. I wanted to change, and I wanted my witness to be potent. And I was starting to walk with the Lord, and I realized in the circle that I was in particularly that cigarettes kind of affected my influence in that environment for all of those reasons. And I had a really, really pretty Irish lady in my life that I married that just, it bummed her out. It really bummed her out. And that was a massive part of it too. And so guess what I couldn't do for a long time? I couldn't put a $5 bill in my pocket for hot dogs and soda for lunch, right? I had to go cashless. I had to pack a lunch and you know, bring a thermos. Because if I had $5 and the dinner bell rang over at Getchell Ice and Brewer where I used to work, stacking ice cubes for 12 hours a day. Guess where I would go with my $5? Not to buy a hot dog, even ever. So I had desire and opportunity, and it came together, and it was a big problem. See, that's a very small example, but that's the deal. And I see this here. Saul, he's staying away from David. He's been humbled, but yet this information comes to him. But they know where he is. They know where he is. And I think I can get there. And I don't think he knows that I know this point, you know. And he has the desire and the opportunity to come together. And he's back at it again. He's on the run again. Going to kill and murder an innocent man. This is the equivalent of a horrible relapse, truthfully, in Saul's life. He takes with him, if you can picture it, 3,000 chosen men. These are elite warriors. These are Green Beret or Navy SEAL type men. The best of the best. And they're not just trained like in a gym somewhere, but they've actually been experienced fighters in battle for years at this point. Best of the best. So he takes plenty of provision, right? Plenty of provision, and he's off. Look at verse 3. Saul pitched in the hill of Hakkelah, which was before Jeshimon, by the way, but David abode in the wilderness, and he saw that Saul came after him in the wilderness. David therefore sent out spies and understood that Saul was come in very deed, or certainly, in some of your newer versions. This is interesting to me, and certainly speaks of the character of David. David is in a vantage point, if you can understand. When you hear wilderness in the Bible, wilderness in Israel, think desert and mountains and dry and arid. We think wilderness here, we think, you know, dense foliage and trees and streams. But the wilderness of Israel was more like desert, okay? So David is in a very barren place, and he can see a long way. He's highly elevated. He sees these 3,000 men, the camp of Saul, from a distance. He's like, you got to be kidding me. That's Saul. You got no way. Is he at it again? And my point is, David, I believe he's the type of guy who forgives. He's the type of guy that wants to believe the best in an individual. And although he sees this guy off in the distance, Saul and his men, he verifies. I just can't accept that, man. He hasn't been doing this for a while. I've been enjoying a little freedom. It seems like since the cave incident, you know, I'm off the hook. But he sends some spies, and they confirm, sorry, David, hate to tell you, he's at it again. So he confirms that Saul is indeed on the way. But I'd just like to stop for a moment and ask us to get personal, because I think that's what Bible study is all about, right? Don't think about your husband, ladies. Think about you. Brothers, don't think about your wives. Think about you. Guys in the front row, don't say, oh, that's perfect, man, that's the man of the week, whoever, he needed to hear this. But there is a heart issue. There's a heart issue when we hear problems and flaws and failures and sin, when we grab onto that. I knew that guy was a fake. There's a problem when we have this critical spirit that we almost are gleeful when we hear about someone's failure or somebody stumbling for, for that matter. You know what I mean? There's something wrong about that. But rather, it is loving, and it's certainly scriptural, to believe the best about people. You know, love believes all things, right? It hopes all things. I want to believe that that individual has overcome. I want to believe that this restoration over there, that they're doing the right thing. And until we have been, it's been confirmed otherwise, I really believe that is the biblical and right position to take. I really do. I'm not saying being naive. I'm not saying that we shouldn't use discernment. I think you guys know exactly what I'm talking about. I am not eager to hear about somebody's failure. And I prefer to believe that God's moving in our church, and I want to be hopeful. And I see that. I really do see that. David had to verify that he indeed was after him. I find that interesting. Let's look at verse 5. David arose and came to the place where Saul had pitched, and David beheld the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the captain of his hosts, and Saul lay in the trench, and the people pitched round about him. Okay, I don't know if you understand what's going on here. This is a very different strategy with David. The last two encounters with Saul, this is what we can expect. And I don't know if you've noticed the change, but David is on the offense all of a sudden. Did you notice that? He doesn't see Saul coming. Oh, you got, and he, come on, guys, we're off again. And he's off hiding and running. But the cave incident, he switched up his game plan, didn't he? He kind of went to Saul. You guys remember he cut off his robe, hem, and it was effective. The battle ended right there. David had the victory that day, and Saul went home. And you see David in this case, I'm not running, I'm done running. And David runs to the camp. He waits for the sun to go down, and he goes to Saul this time, and he spies out the scene. He sees Saul, like a little tyrant would, right in the middle of 3,000 people, right? Wants to catch some shut-eye. And you're like a little queen bee. He's in the middle of all those drones, protected and comfortable and snoozing. Well taken care of by all his little minions. That's the deal. But you guys know, if you know the scriptures, this is going to end very similar to the cave situation. Saul is going to be humiliated, and he's going to walk away from this whole thing. My point is this, guys. I really believe spiritual warfare and spiritual battle, just like David, it's unrelenting. You might have brief moments of reprieve where, like, man, things are going really good. And this is what was told me as a young Christian. Here's the deal. There's always a storm coming. You're either in the midst of the storm, but if you look up and you see blue sky, it's just because the storm has just passed. There's another one right behind it. It is the will of God for us to understand as Christians, we are in constant warfare. We don't wrestle with flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. You guys understand that? So if you're new to the faith, don't be confused or shocked. I don't get it. I mean, I gave my life to Christ, and my life has gotten harder since I gave my life to Christ. There is a very real war that we're in the midst of. It's a spiritual war. And think about it like this. Without Christ, we're dead in our trespasses and sins. That's what the scriptures teach. And it's cliche, I realize, but for the sake of the new people, any dead fish can float downstream, man. And the stream is the current of this world. It's really easy to just jump in the current of this world and just let it rip you downstream and do what everybody else does, fly underneath the radar. You don't need a spine to live in this world. You just say yes to everything. Nobody ever gets offended because you never speak truth.
Notice something. You're going to notice that as a fish now with some life, you find yourself turning around and facing the current. And all of a sudden, there's this resistance in life, and you got family members upset with you. Why are you going to church so much? Why do you believe this? You always believe that. And everything changes, actually. And it is important for us to understand, like David, you might have some moments where you're like, man, Saul, he must be in the palace. I'm left alone. Things are nice. Things are easy. Things are quiet. But you look out over the horizon. Oh, there he is again. But here's the deal. Here's the deal. And here's what Christ taught. He said, upon this rock, that's who Christ is, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail. And here's something. I'd say it to the front row, and I'd say it to everybody all the way to the back row. to live our lives as Christians in constant defense, running and hiding and just focusing on all the things we're not supposed to do, man, that is absolutely exhausting, and it's just a matter of time. When you're focused on what not to do, guess what you're focused on? All the wrong things. But I'm telling you, it is scriptural, like David. There's a point where you take the battle too, right? You're on the offense. You're praying. You're quoting scripture. You're confronting. You're dealing. You're exposing. And that, I'm telling you, that's where the victory is in Christ. It's not running and hiding. It's not assuming the fetal position. It's exposing and confronting and being on offense. There's a lot in that as it relates to just simple prayer, truthfully. But please consider that. Here David is not running like he used to. He's going to. You get the scene. We're introduced to a new character, this character Abner. Effectively, he is serving as Saul's general. He comes up quite a bit here in just a moment. Okay. Verse 6. Then answered David and said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, brother to Joab, saying, who, don't miss this, please, who will go down with me to Saul to the camp? Before we look at the response to that, did you guys catch that? Did you guys catch what David said? He said, who will go down with me to the camp? He's asking for a buddy, not an entire army. He's just asking for a comrade, a accountability partner. Someone to do life with, some to risk some things with. But what I love about this, and what an amazing contrast, right? You got Saul, who is snoozing, and he's surrounded by 3,000 warriors that are protecting him. You know, perfect picture of a tyrant. But then you have David, who, unlike a tyrant, doesn't say to his 600, get down there right now, guys, and deal with that for me. He says, not go do, he says, let's go do. Do you guys see the difference? Do you see the servant leadership in that? David isn't asking any of his men to do anything he is not willing to do himself. Now that's leadership. And I don't care if you're a basketball coach or you're in the ministry or you're a dad. That is servant leadership. A dad can sit in his chair with his scepter, looks like a remote control, and he can order everybody to go do all that he needs done. But it isn't effective leadership. It really isn't effective leadership. But when you are like the Lord Jesus taught, you want to be chief, you got a desire to be great, you got a desire to be influential, then be the servant of everyone. Guys, this works on a job site. You want a loyal crew on a job site? Don't be that boss that says, go do this and blah, 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 and hurry up. Do you see your crew as existing to make your life easier and to make you some money? I can't help but bringing this pastor thing on the job site. And I can't help but having this Jesus stuff in my mind where you want to be chief, then you got to serve everybody. It's true in ministry, pastoral ministry. It's true in politics. It's true on the ball fields and on the basketball courts. It's true in our homes, Dad. If you want to be an influential leader, you better roll up your sleeves and involve yourself in whatever you're asking everybody else to do. Now you have a potent leader. That's David. Come on, who's with me? I'm going down. I'm going to risk it all today. Who's with me? And praise God, you actually don't have, which is awesome, right? You don't have 600 men going, here, 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 here. You have Abishai going, count me in, David. And the truth is, guys, as long as you have one Abishai, you're good, right? As long as you have one friend with a weak mind and a strong back, just kidding. As long as you have one friend that's filled with faith and courage and boldness from Christ, that's more accurate. Man, you can get a lot done. You think about the partnerships in the scriptures, guys. Paul and Barnabas. Man, they rocked the Mediterranean world for Christ, and unbelievable cities and churches were planted as those men partnered up and preached the gospel. You got Paul and Silas. You have Paul and Timothy. We could go on and on, guys. The partnerships that we read about in the scriptures, not the droves of people, but just the two. One more thing, I'd like to think about marriages like this. Man, the scriptures talk about marriages being joint heirs. Man, brothers in the room, you have been blessed with a helper that's spirit-filled, way more sensitive than you, probably smarter than you, truthfully. Definitely aware of spiritual things. And, you know, do you see your wife as a weapon in your arsenal? Do you see your husbands as just that, ladies? I mean, when a marriage comes together and they realize, man, let's do this together. What a force. What an amazing force. But don't you think for a second that same force is known by our enemy? And if he can get some infighting going on, that couple's useless for the kingdom. And that's tragic, guys. And we let it happen. Waste all of our best thoughts and our best arguments and debates on each other. And we waste all our energy. We stay up all night. We should be sleeping. Oh, no, you're not sleeping. We're going to deal with this tonight at 1 a.m. We're still talking about this. Right? And then you're useless the next day. Don't you think for a minute the enemy's not behind that, wanting to divide and exhaust. And, oh, man, it's not the way it's supposed to be. But, you know, she's pretty, but I got an Abishai. I really do. I thank God for that lady I'm married to, man. I consider, you want to do this together? And she's that, yeah, count me in. You nut. We're going to get killed. But it'll be fun. I got one of those ladies. I got one of them lifers. Don't you dare tell her either. Don't you dare tell her that my plans are bad. She thinks I'm wise. She thinks I'm hearing from the Lord. Don't you screw it up for me. But it's a beautiful thing, man, when we can work together and risk it all for the sake of the gospel. It's a pretty awesome thing. Who will go down with me to Saul, to the camp? That's pretty gutsy, by the way. Abishai said, I'll go down with thee. I love it. So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench, his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster. But Abner and the people lay round about him. So everybody's sleeping. David sneaks down there. Man, what kind of guts that took. And you know, he's being stealthy. He's being quiet. He's good at this. He's been doing it for a decade. He creeps down there in the night. And then he sees that chest sleeping, that big Saul, head and shoulders above the people. And he sees this spear that's just next to his head, stuck in the ground. So he can wake up and grab it, right? Everything's set up. He's got a little canteen of water, and he's watching all of Saul's elite officers. They're sawing logs too. And no doubt David, because he's a warrior, no doubt he has a kind of a grimacing smile flash across his face, and he's like, you got to be kidding me, man. This is unbelievable. And they're just quiet. They're just watching. They're just observing the scene. You know, you guys have been sneaking into your deer stands. You know, you're taking those, you know, one step every 2 minutes. You know, they're sneaking through the night like that. But we don't want to scare off a deer. These guys don't want to wake up 3,000 Green Berets. You know that. So can you imagine, you know, where David and Abishai are at? Man, their adrenaline is just through the roof. But this is my favorite part of this chapter. You got to love Abishai here. Verse 8 says, Then said Abishai to David, God, I can't prove it, but he's got a little quiver in his voice, I think. God has delivered thine enemy into thine hand this day. Now, therefore, let me smite him. Don't you love that? I mean, if you don't have an appetite for this, that's fine, but he's a warrior. And he also knows that David kind of choked last time. Got a deal. You can't. He's just looking at Saul. He's not looking at David. He's just looking at Saul. David, I got a deal for you. Let me do it. Let me do it this time, you gutless wonder you. That way you're off the hook. Your kingdom won't be tainted. You won't have an assassination. I'll be the bad guy for you. Doesn't that sound great? Now, you got to love this Abishai fella. Let me smite him. And then he goes on to say this, and he gives a little bit of a description. Hope this is okay. It's definitely rated R. You ready? Here we go. I pray thee with the spear even to the earth at once. I will not smite him a second time. You guys understand what he's saying? Let me grab that spear right there and let me stick it to the ground. I won't need a second opportunity. I promise you, I'll get it right the first time. This guy has put a few spears in a few people. He knows right where they go to make him stop wiggling. Sorry about that. So he's pleading with David, please. And then here's David, right? David said to Abishai, destroy him not. For who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? Man, that's a good friend right there, because David wouldn't do it. He wouldn't kill. He wouldn't destroy the Lord's anointed. And he wouldn't let his friends do it either. That's an awesome friend. You know what? I'm not going to let you do it, Abishai. It's wrong no matter who does it. That's a man God has chosen. And yeah, he's got some problems. And yeah, he has destroyed our life. He's made our life miserable. I'm not going to let you kill him. I'm absolutely not going to let you kill him. It would be wrong, and you would have guilt for doing that. That's an awesome friend. Guys, I think that's probably one of the reasons why God would have us do things in pairs. There's a lot of accountability that comes with that, isn't there? It's nice to serve with somebody, and when you're in that pickle or you're in that vulnerable situation, it's night and day when there's a brother there saying, you know what, you can't do that. I'm not going to let you go ahead with it, bud. Sorry, not going to happen. I'm not going to look at your wife. You know, I'm not going to look at your kids and let you do that. It's awesome to have an accountability partner, I would say. So David will not do it. And what a temptation for David too, brothers and sisters. Man, this is the second time. And you know, there's all this stuff that could be going through his mind. God, are you in it now? But he's resolved. What's wrong is wrong. There's never a scenario where it wouldn't be wrong as far as David is concerned. And he's just not interested in taking the kingdom like this. David said, furthermore, as the Lord lives, the Lord shall smite him. Or his day shall come to die, and he shall descend into battle and perish. You know what, Abishai? We're going to let God deal with that. We're going to let God deal with this man. God knows he's wrong. God knows he's in sin for what he's done. God knows the grief that he's caused us. We are going to trust God to deal with this man. And I believe it's going to happen. I believe God's going to deal with it. It's easy to read about this, isn't it, guys? Easy to read about this in a warm church on a Wednesday night. It's another thing altogether to live this, isn't it? To really let God deal with our battles. Let God vindicate. Let God prove. Let God, you know, take care of the stuff that we desperately think we should take care in our own strength. But that's David, see? That's David. The Lord forbid that I should stretch forth my hand against the Lord's anointed, but I pray thee, take thee now the spear at his bolster and the cruse of water, and let's go. We need to prove that we were here. Once again, we need to prove that we could have killed him, but we're better men than that, Abishai. So let's take the spear, let's take the water, and let's bounce now. That's the idea. So David took the spear and the cruse of water from Saul's bolster, and they got them away, and no man saw it nor knew it, neither awaked, Old English, for they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord was fallen upon them. Two things here. First of all, we see that God was in this. God was allowing for this test in David's life. Factor that in, guys. God will allow tests in our life because he wants to purify and strengthen our faith. He's not trying to cause us to sin ever, but he does allow, absolutely allows tests, and God was certainly behind all of this. But it's interesting to me, guys, it's interesting to me that everybody around Saul felt relaxed enough to sleep. What's that tell me? David's got a reputation for himself at this point, doesn't he? We don't got to worry about that guy. He's been, you know, in the dark right up to King Saul with a sharp blade and passed him by. It's interesting the way David has modeled life. I would suggest to you everybody's kind of at ease. They're going along with King Saul. Here we go again. They're following their orders. But at the end of the day, they don't think Saul's in danger from David. They really don't. Because David has proven himself to be different than that. I would suggest to you that's why there is kind of a lull in the security here. Then, of course, God gets involved and kind of wipes them all out, puts them in a deep sleep. Verse 13. David went over to the other side, and he stood at the top of the hill afar off, a great space being between them. And David cried to the people and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Answerest thou not Abner?" And Abner answered and said, "Who art you that cries to the king?" So David wakes the whole scene up, just starts shouting out into the dark, and specifically calling General Abner by name. Abner wakes up. "Who are you? Who's calling out? Who is addressing the king?" And then here we go. And David said to Abner, "Are not you a valiant? I thought you were a hero. And who is like you in Israel?" That's what I'm hearing about this Abner, that you're a hero. "When or wherefore then hast thou not kept the Lord thy king? For there came one out of the people to destroy the king thy Lord. This thing's not good that you have done." Yeah, David is certainly taunting this man. "As the Lord lives, you are worthy to die, because you have not kept your master, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is and the cruse of water that was at his bolster." So there's some trash talk going on here. Again, I hope you have a stomach for all that. But David is suggesting to this general, "Man, you screwed up out there, Mr. Bold Guy, Mr. Valiant. You really screwed up. You call yourself loyal to the king, but just so you know, somebody was going to kill the king tonight, and you were snoozing. Don't believe me? Where's the king's spear, Mr. Abner? Where's his water?" And here he is waving it up here on the hill. "That's right. You're worthy of death. You are a pathetic excuse of a general." That's kind of the idea in light of what David is doing. And let's look at it from this angle, guys. That's extremely bold, isn't it? That's David provoking some of the most dangerous, in fact, the most dangerous men in that military, 3,000 of them. Saul could say, "Get them, boys," and they could just tear over the hill, and potentially this would be it for David. And what I'm concluding from all this, guys, is David, as we know, he's a man who spends time in the presence of God. And check it out. When you spend time in the presence of God, you do not fear man. You just don't. You don't have a fear of man. When you're willing to tremble in the presence of God, you'll never tremble in the presence of a human. And that's what I see here. There is such a boldness to this man, and it's all about his relationship with God. You know, I mentioned Sunday, and I stand behind the statement that the cruelest form of slavery is the fear of man. Just subject to the opinions of people and just terrified of what people might think and the horrible anxieties and insecurities that come from that. But man, to have a relationship with God, it affects all of that, doesn't it? Those of you that walk with God, you spend time in prayer, you have a dynamic relationship with him, you could stand in front of 1,000 people or you could stand in front of the most significant people. And man, when you hang out with God, who are you? Mr. President, great to meet you. Step aside, right? Do you know my Jesus? I mean, I know the answer to that question. I'm not asking, but you get the point, right? It's just the way it goes, brothers and sisters, and I certainly see that with David here. It tells us in verse 17, we better finish up, and we will. That Saul knew David's voice and said, "Is this thy voice, my son David?" And David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king." And he said, "Wherefore doth my lord thus pursue after his servant? Why are you doing this again, Saul? Haven't we dealt with this already? I thought we were beyond this. What have I done, or what evil is in my hand?" Again, if you're new to the story, you should know Saul simply hates David because he was threatened by David's talent and David's effectiveness, threatened by his youth and his zeal and his love for God. That's it. David hasn't done anything. "Now therefore," verse 19, "I pray thee, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred thee up against me, let him accept an offer." In other words, if I've done something wrong, if God is using you to purge my life from sin, then by all means, let me make things right. Let me offer an offering for my sin. And he's speaking from a Jewish perspective. That's what they would do, by the way. I'm willing to get right if there's anything in my life that needs to be checked. But if they be the children of men, cursed be they before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. I want you guys to follow David's thinking here. It goes like this. If this is a human thing, if your pursuit of me is all about the heart of man, envy, jealousy, competition, do you understand how this is damaging my life? Do you understand, Saul, this crazy jealous pursuit of me? It's literally keeping me from the presence of God. I can't even worship in the temple. And what you're saying to me, who's done nothing wrong, an innocent man who served you wholeheartedly, what you're saying to me is you might as well go be a pagan. And that was the biggest challenge or the biggest trial to David. Isn't that interesting? It's not the inconvenience of living outside and camping. And that must have been a drag after 10 years of doing it. It wasn't being away from his precious wife and the comforts of marriage. And that must have been a real drag to have his bride, the love of his life, be given away to another man. That must have destroyed, in fact, I believe it did, destroy David. But what really grieved David above all is, I can't even go to church, man. I can't go to the temple and come into the presence of God. You guys might as well be saying to me, go be a pagan. Go serve other gods. You've ostracized me from my faith. Now, if you know the narrative of David, that's a very staggering statement from David. And I wouldn't say that chapter 27 is his brightest chapter. From this point, I would suggest that David goes into a pretty serious discouragement season and depression, and he goes and dwells with the Philistines and probably has some dark chapters in his life. We'll deal with that next week. But this is nothing less than a very discouraged man. But man, he sure wishes he could be in the presence of God, and from a Jewish perspective, that would mean in the temple. And of course, he can't because they'd kill him if he did. Verse 20. Now therefore let not my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Lord, for the king of Israel has come out to seek a flea, as when one does hunt a partridge in the mountains. Why am I so important? I'm not worth all this, Saul. I'll tell you right now, I'm not worth all this. I'm just me. This is ridiculous, is kind of the idea. Then said Saul, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do thee harm, because my soul was precious in thine eyes this day. Behold, I have played the fool, I have erred exceedingly. I just, for you note takers, you should know, that's the last recorded words of Saul before his death. How would you like that to be what goes down in the history books? The last thing King Saul says, I've played the fool, I have erred exceedingly. He admitted publicly that he was wrong. That's good. But what a sad thing to go down in history. As far as his statement to David, a public statement to David, this is the last thing he says for the record to David. I've played the fool and have erred. See, he never reconciles. There's never forgiveness. He never takes back this. He just makes that statement. That's a horrible place to be, guys. Horrible place to be. And you don't want that in your life. I don't want that in my life. I don't want my last chapter of life to say, man, what a fool I've been. I stepped right into that trap, and I've erred exceedingly. What we do want to say, the last chapter of our life, right, is I fought a good fight. I finished my course. I've kept the faith. Don't you want to be able to say that? Even if we're dragging ourselves across the finish line, don't you want to say, guys, for the record, I did it, Lord. You did it through me. We can make sure all of our terminology is proper, but we finished our course. I certainly know that's where your pastor's heart is at. I want to be able to say that. I did what you gave me to do, Lord. I certainly don't want to say this. But you see how this offensive tactic has caused Saul to say, all right, I'm done. And he calls it off again. I'm telling you, offense is better than defense when it comes to spiritual warfare. Know that. David answered and said, I'm in verse 22, behold, the king's spear. Let one of your young men come over and fetch it. David is bold, but he's not stupid, right? I'm not going to go down there and give it to you. You send one of your young warriors, come up. You come get your spear. I don't want it, but I just want you to know I had it. So send up one of your little greenhorns and or your caddies, and I'll give him your spear. The Lord rendered to every man his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered thee into my hand today, but I would not stretch forth my hand against the Lord's anointed. That's what David goes down in the record of saying as far as last exchange with Saul. I would not kill you, and I had opportunity because I'm trusting the Lord to deal with that. And behold, as thy life was much set by this day in mine eyes, so let my life be much set by in the eyes of the Lord. And let him deliver me out of all tribulation. Just like the Lord delivered you from me, I'm actually confident that God will do that for me, Saul. I'm not confident in you at all at this point. Then Saul said to David, blessed be thou, my son David, that thou shalt both do great things and shall still prevail. So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. So David leaves the presence of Saul. Saul returns home. Again, that's over. That pursuit is over. But you'll see in chapter 27, David's heart is heavy. And he, at this point, he's like, well, I guess it's just a matter of time, and I'm gonna die out here. And he goes and joins the world for a season. Becomes quite violent, and I think there's a lot going on in David that's working his way out through his actions. We'll look at that next week for sure.